places. Everyone.
We're now broadcasting.
Roll the tape in. 3, 2.
A new audio drama.
Appaloosa Radio is where stories come alive.
A Woman of Substance. An original audio story for Appaloosa Radio. In dedication to Mrs. K. Fetner. I was playing with some of my cousins and my younger brothers up by the big chestnut tree, the one my pap always refused to cut down. The tree had the blight and should have been cut down and the stump burned. But my pap liked that tree. He would never cut it down. To us kids, it did not matter that it had the blight. It was ours to climb on and to hide in. We were glad that he'd never cut it down. Anyways, I was playing with my kin up by that big tree. Then, I heard my pap say, "Eugenia." He said it loud with a stern voice. I knew to come running when he called me like that. He was sitting on the porch next to a gentleman wearing his best Sunday go-to-meet in dark suit. The gentleman had some gray hair at the temples, and he was beginning to bald. When I came up the steps to the porch, both men stood up. My pap spoke. "Eugenia, I want you to meet Mr. Winston Garrison." "Pleased to meet you, sir." My pap continued. "Mr. Garrison is an engineer for the Missouri Pacific Railroad. He has a house up in Omega." His voice trailed off. I waited for him to complete his sentence. "Eugenia, Mr. Garrison is going to be your new husband. I've promised him that we can make it official next week in the Parsons' house at the Presbyterian Church in Omega." I did not know what to say. I simply stood there. I was just 13 years old. My pap had been terribly worried since it happened. It was probably the worst thing that had ever happened to me. The very worst. I had just turned 13. My cousin Jerome was the boy cousin that I liked the best. He was good looking, tall, and strong. He was also very musical with a wonderful voice. He could play any kind of music if and he heard it just once. He was also just fun to be with, always had an easy laugh for everything. One Saturday afternoon after he did his shift at the sawmill, he asked me to take a walk with him. Of course, I was glad to go with him cause I really liked him. He told me to bring a blanket since it was something like a picnic. We walked up over the ridge to where the abandoned sawmill stood. It had closed 20 or so years ago. Now all the sawmill work went directly to the big mill in Omega where Jerome now worked. There's a creek just beyond the old mill where my family sometimes went for summer picnics. Jerome and me walked by the old sawmill and up to where the creek ran, but he said it was too muddy. "We'll have to use the old office." He took my hand and led me across the abandoned mill yard to the one-room office. The windows were broken out, but there was still a large wooden table and some chairs. Inside the office, Jerome pulled up my dress and started feeling me where he shouldn't. I did not think he ought to be doing that, and I told him so. That just made him mad. Really, really mad. He grabbed my dress and ripped it clean off. Then, he began doing stuff. Stuff I don't want to talk about. When the family learned what Jerome had done to me, they sent him away. I think he went up to Kansas City and started working in the stockyards. At least that is what I heard. My mother and my father had an earnest conversation about me. I wasn't spying or nothing. They were speaking in a normal voice. Not in a secret whisper. Just their normal voice. My ma said, she has got the body of a grown woman. And that's dangerous. My pap said, some of the other bucks are going to start getting the same ideas. Can't help it. They're young. Full of sass. Then my ma said, maybe it'd be best if and she got married. Finally my pap concluded, yeah. She's real pretty. I think I can find a man. What my pap never told my ma was that he owed a man a substantial sum of money. A widower with his own house who was an engineer on the railroad. With time so hard, and jobs so scarce, Eugenia would be better off than most, he thought out loud. There always would be a railroad and trains always need engineers. My husband, Mr. Winston Paul Garrison, Jr. was an upright man, a Mason who sometimes went to church. Because his father also worked on the Missouri Pacific Railroad, everyone always called him W.P. Not me. I always called him Mr. Garrison. That's what he liked and what I preferred. He was 37 when he married me. I knew he was a widower. However, I learned much later that I was his third wife, not his second. It was an ugly story that W.P. never told anyone. Before he transferred from the Southern Missouri District to the North Arkansas District of the Railroad, before he was ever promoted to engineer, back when he was still a gangly teenager, working as a brakeman, he married, or at least got together with, a woman named Yolanda. Yolanda may have been a mulatta, maybe a colored girl who looked perfectly white. Nobody knew for sure. Anyway, W.P. and Yolanda had a son, Caleb, but Caleb had mental issues. He was never right. He had problems. Lots of problems. W.P. didn't like Caleb. He would beat him, call him names, then call Yolanda names, threaten to kill them both. One day when my husband came home from working his shift on the railroad, he found that some way, somehow, Yolanda had been shot with a shotgun. One bloody mess. When the sheriff came, W.P. told him that he had found 4-year-old Caleb wandering around the yard, dragging the shotgun behind him. Poor, dumb thing. Didn't know what he did. A couple years later, Mr. W.P. Garrison was promoted to engineer and transferred to the Northern Arkansas Railroad District. He bought a house in Omega and married his second wife, Darla. He never let Caleb live with them. He paid a woman to take Caleb in. Sometimes Caleb, now himself a gangling teenager, would wander by the Garrison's house in Omega. But W.P. would always chase him away with the threat of a gun. Poor, dumb thing. Nobody ever wanted him around. Poor dumb thing. Omega, Arkansas was 6 miles from Charlie where Eugenia's family lived, but in terms of progress, the two towns were separated by more than a century. Charlie had two churches, a store with a gas station, and a decrepit non-working sawmill. No electricity. No plumbing, just outhouses over a creek. No one ever going anywhere. Everyone in Charlie had one of four very specific surnames: Cardwell, Evans, Middleton, or Tolliver. All the families were interrelated, most were cousins or aunts or in-laws of each other. Omega, on the other hand, had a school with 450 students, churches of every denomination, had electric and telephone service, 3 banks, a canning factory, bead stores, a machine shop, 2 sawmills, a Ford dealer, lumber yards, and the Missouri Pacific roundhouses. In the 1930s, Omega, Arkansas had an additional economic advantage. Just north of town on U.S. Highway 65, a group of businesses developed only yards south of the Arkansas-Missouri border. Arkansas had lower gas taxes than Missouri. It was convenient and profitable for Missouri residents to drive south and buy their gasoline in Omega. Likewise, northbound travelers on U.S. Highway 65 would stop in Omega to gas up before crossing the state line, and southbound travelers would squeeze a few additional miles out of their vehicles to take advantage of the lower taxes in Arkansas. Despite the Depression, Omega, Arkansas was thriving. I was 14 and already a wife and a mother. As I now remember those times, I remember that I was both frightened and excited over my new role. More than anything else, I wanted to please Mr. Garrison, my husband. I was always trying to make him happy and trying, at the same time, to be a good mother to my new baby boy, John. However, I was just 14, and there were many things I did not know. My husband was a very demanding man. He had expectations that I could not always meet. Mr. Garrison wore denim overalls in the cab of the locomotives that he drove. Now, the cab of a steam-driven locomotive was a filthy place. Coal dust. Grease. Road dust. Tobacco spit. Smoke. Yet, Mr. Garrison demanded that his work overalls be spotless whenever he left for work. I had to scrub everything off, getting them spanking new clean. I had to wash them, hang them on the line to dry, fold them, and make darn sure they were ready. Every day, I spent hours bent over a washtub, scrubbing Mr. Garrison's grimy overalls. Of course, I had to do all that while nursing baby John, and he often got real fussy. On Tuesday evenings, Mr. Garrison went to his lodge meetings. He always wore a suit and a clean white shirt. I had to take special care to make sure the starch was just right. Too much and he would be unhappy. Too little, he would hit me. I had to cook for Mr. Garrison, fixing him whatever he demanded. It was a coal-fired stove, and it took me a while to learn how to cook on it. One time, I burned the biscuits. I remember that. He beat me. Beat me hard. Mr. Garrison demanded that the house be immaculately clean. Every day, I cleaned the house, dusting, sweeping, and scrubbing. Sometimes, Mr. Garrison would inspect my cleaning. If it was not to his standards, he would beat me. If the baby, John, became fussy and cried, Mr. Garrison would yell and get mad. One day when I was washing Mr. Garrison's clothes, I realized that he was mad at Eugenia, but I was not Eugenia. No, I was now Jean. That's Jean with a double letter N in the middle and an E at the end. No, I was not Eugenia. She was somebody else. Some dumb girl from Charlie, Arkansas. That was not me. I used to tell myself that he was mad at Eugenia. I would tell myself that I am no longer Eugenia. No. I was now Jean. That's Jean with a double letter N in the middle and an E at the end. He was mad at her. Not me. Not me. Once Mr. Garrison became so angry at Eugenia that he stormed out of the house and spent the night drinking and playing pool at a roadhouse up on Highway 65. He accused her of poor fiscal management. Of buying things they did not need. Of spending too much on household necessities. Of course, every night in the bedroom, he demanded that she perform wifely activities. If she did not sufficiently stimulate him, Mr. Garrison would beat her or pull her hair or rip her clothes. Eugenia was just 14. There was much that she did not know. Jean had no age, but there was much she wanted to learn. Darla, WP's previous wife, was only 2 years younger than he was. He met her at the Presbyterian Church. She was very much a church-going lady. Her father owned one of Omega's three banks, and like WP was a ranking officer in the Masonic Lodge. Around Darla and her family, WP was a well-mannered gentleman who seemed to be both serious and responsible. The couple's courtship lasted nearly a year. As their wedding gift, Darla's father bought them a house at the corner of Randall and Chestnut, in Omega's best neighborhood.
W.P. seemed very much in love with his wife.
He bought her special gifts and read poetry to her. He took her to Little Rock to buy special furniture for the house. He even hired her a maid and a part-time housekeeper. He seemed genuinely heartbroken when she unexpectedly died from a meningitis epidemic. She was just 31. Mr. Winston Paul Garrison never valued Eugenia. She came from red dirt poor Ozark hillbillies, she had only attended school to the fifth grade, and she spoke with a distinctive Arkansas twang. Most importantly, she was just a teenage girl. She did not know anything. He believed that in punishing her, he was teaching her. Teaching how to do things right. To do the things that wives should already know. He often felt that in accepting Eugenia as payment for a debt, he had made a mistake. Probably better to have kept the money. On one of his regular runs down to Harrison, WP met a very attractive young widow. He began asking dispatch to schedule him on the route south so he could do a layover in Harrison. Soon, he was asking to do overnight layovers. To do overnight layovers meant he had to take the longer routes, like runs from Memphis to Kansas City. It did not bother him that by taking the longer runs, he left Eugenia and her baby alone for longer and longer periods, sometimes two or three times each week. They could take care of themselves. Caleb would come by the house when Mr. Garrison was away. He was a gentle soul. He never meant any harm, especially to this beautiful, young woman and her baby. He helped her to wash the clothes, helped with the housekeeping, and ran errands, when needed. He wasn't smart, but he was not as dumb as his father thought. He remembered things. Things that others had forgot. In the evenings, after she went to bed, Caleb would sit outside her gate on a stool, with a shotgun laying in his lap. $435 to buy a bright red, 1934 model of Ford. It was not new. A couple of years old. I think it had originally belonged to a traveling salesman, but it did not have too many miles and was still a sweet running little thing. On his days off, Mr. Garrison often took it for drives. Most of the time, he would not take Eugenia and the baby along. Driving off by himself. Now, some women fall in love with the handsome men on the movie screen. Me? I fell in love with that car. Loved it as much as I ever loved anything. I loved its shape. I loved the sound of the engine. I loved the tires, the lights, the horn, the windshield. When Mr. Garrison was at home, the car was his. A special toy that he used to show off to his friends. He liked to say that it was the kind of car that a movie star might drive. The kind of car they drove in Little Rock and Memphis. The kind of car that showed everyone that you were important. None of that mattered to me. I love the red Model A as the beautiful machine that it was. It was not about the prestige or status that it brought. It was just simply beautiful. I told Mr. Garrison that I would wash and polish the red Model A for him, and he was glad that I did. He came back from his drives plenty tired, needing a nice, long nap. While Mr. Garrison was working, Jean taught herself how to drive the red Model A. There was a book of instructions, but Jean did not need it. She knew intuitively what to do. Easy peasy. No problems. Jean was plenty smart. She figured it out. Drove that car all around Omega when Mr. Garrison was working. Up and down every street. Even up US Highway 65, across the Missouri border. Jean was born to drive. A natural. A woman of pure talent. A very substantial person. Jean was born to drive. A natural. A woman of pure talent. A very substantial person. The red Model E developed a problem in its carburetor, a problem that even very talented Jean could not work out. She drove it to the Ford dealer and waited there while the mechanics worked on the car. The dealer had worked on the car before. He knew that it belonged to Mr. W.P. Garrison. No problem about paying for the repairs. What was unusual was that Mr. Garrison allowed his wife to drive his car. Not many Arkansas men did that. Still, she seemed a pretty confident driver, so probably not an issue. As the mechanic worked on the car, the young woman watched intently, noting which wrench was used to do what. And, she asked questions. Not silly questions, but questions that showed she understood what was going on. This woman, the mechanic thought, seems better than some of the apprentices I have trained. Mr. Winston Paul Garrison could not finish his run to Memphis. A bridge had been washed out in the recent thunderstorms. Instead of doing his usual layover, he deadheaded back north to Omega. So, his return was unexpected. When he came to his house, he found both his car and his wife gone. He grabbed his shotgun and set off to retrieve his missing property. Eugenia and her baby John were still at the Ford dealership in Omega where the carburetor of the Model A was being repaired. They had been there all morning and the mechanic was now reattaching the fuel system. Eugenia had enthusiastically watched him work on the car. She did not know that her husband had come home unexpectedly. Downtown Omega, Arkansas was in 1936, five blocks long. The garrison's house was at the corner of Randall and Chestnut, two blocks west of the town's main street. W.P. Garrison left his house, angrily walked up Randall and rounded the corner at 2nd Street onto Omega's main street where the Ford dealer was located. As he did so, he was confronted by his son, Caleb, who was also carrying a shotgun. In the official police report, the officers noted,
"There was an exchange of gunfire between the parties. The father, Mr. Winston Paul Garrison, discharged his firearm. At same moment, son, Caleb, last name unknown, also discharged his firearm. When officers arrived, they found that Mr. Winston Paul Garrison lay dead on the sidewalk. Caleb, last name unknown, stood over him, his own left arm bleeding profusely. Son having killed his own father. Father wounding son. When asked by officers to hand over the gun, Caleb, last name unknown, did so willingly, and then followed the officer's request and climbed into the back seat of the town's patrol car."
Years later, Jean tried to recall the events of her last day in Omega, Arkansas. Unfortunately, she now remembered two distinct, but contradictory narratives. Things are very confused in her mind. Even now, all these years later. In one narrative, Eugenia stayed at the Ford dealership while all the commotion happened down the block. She only left the Ford dealership after a police officer came to interview her. Then she drove the Model E Ford home, packed a small suitcase of baby John's things, and she left town early the next morning, way before dawn. In the other narrative, the one Jean now preferred, she finished the car's repairs herself, and then immediately drove the Model E Ford out of town before the police arrived to interview her. In this narrative, she imagined that the police were still looking for her, believing that Eugenia may have had something to do with Caleb's actions. I did not, of course. Nothing. Caleb had been behaving strangely. I mean real strange. He came by the house last Wednesday, just after Mr. Garrison left for his run. That weren't too unusual. He'd come by now and then, just to help out and to do things for me. But last week, he was acting strange. He said he was Mr. Garrison's son by a previous marriage, but he didn't have the Garrison name because he wasn't allowed it. He told me that we needed to leave Omega quickly because he had a bad dream about things to come. Eugenia had told him that was silly. She didn't believe in evil omens and things like that. Besides, things had gotten better. Eugenia said that she was learning how to do things better. How to better please Mr. Garrison. Lately, he didn't get so mad anymore. Nope. He was getting better. Things were better. I didn't have no plan or anything when I left Omega, Arkansas. I had never been anywhere. I was born and raised in Charlie, and then was married in Omega. Just 6 miles between the two. Never been anywhere. Nowhere. But, I knew how to drive the red Model IA Ford, and I was as good a driver as any man. I knew I wanted to go away. To go far away. I could have driven north on US Highway 65. That's how most of the traffic went. North, up into Missouri. But, I thought, if I went that way, they would find me. And I didn't want to be found. I did not want to go back to Omega. And there was nothing for me in Charlie. So, I took the twisty county road west, eventually crossing all of Arkansas and ending up in Oklahoma. I can tell you for sure that no one was following me. I had $21 in my purse. I had taken it out of Mr. Garrison's metal strongbox to pay to fix the car. However, I left town without paying the mechanic's bill. With it, I headed west with Baby John, driving that red 1934 Model E Ford. Every couple of hours, I would stop to nurse and take care of John. He did not cry or fuss. I think he liked the drive. In Oklahoma, I bought $2 worth of gasoline and had the attendant check the tires and the radiator's water. 30 miles further west, I came to Tulsa, the biggest city that I had ever seen. I stayed on the main highway and eventually found a motor cabin hotel where John and I spent the night. It cost me $1.50 because it had a bathtub, but I could indulge myself in personal privacy. Never had I slept in a bed by myself. Nor could I ever stay in the bathtub until my skin turned pink and wrinkled. For a mountain gal from Charlie, Arkansas, I was in pure luxury. It was in Tulsa that I permanently gave up Eugenia in favor of Jean. Since I had changed my first name, I decided to change my last name as well. I did not want any of the family names that were so common in Charlie. I would not be Jean Cardwell or Jean Evans or Middleton or Tolliver. It did not take me long to pick a new name that I really liked. I would henceforth be Jean Ford. To be more precise, I would be Jean A. Ford. I never really decided what the A stood for. Maybe Anne or Alice or Alexandra. It did not really matter. No one ever asked me. I was Jean Ford, and that was enough for everyone. In Tulsa, I also bought new clothes. I had left Omega wearing just my cotton house frock, my everyday dress. When I got married, Mr. Garrison bought me a dress for the wedding. It was pretty old-fashioned. I wore it to church, the few times that we went, and for Baby John's infant dedication, but after the baby came, I did not like how it fit. Besides, it had lots of buttons and eye hooks, and was hard to unfasten to nurse Baby John. I am not sorry to say that I left it behind when I drove off from Omega. I bought a rouge-colored, wool business suit, three blouses, and Scandal, a pair of women's trousers. I felt the trousers were a necessity for driving the Model E. In Tulsa, I wore my new business suit to an employment agency, and they found me a job at an insurance company as a receptionist. I worked there 2 weeks before they decided to let me go. They needed someone who could type, and I could not. They were nice people, not mean. They paid me the $14 they owed me with no problems or complaints. Then, I paid the woman who had been babysitting John the $1.50 I owed her and decided it was time to move on. Jean Ford and her son John cranked up the red Model A and headed north into Kansas. In 1936, Fort Leavenworth was the nation's busiest Army base. It housed the so-called Army War College, which provided advanced tactical training to the Army's most senior career officers. Each Army regiment selected one of its officers to attend the prestigious two-year specialized command-oriented training program. Fort Leavenworth also housed the federal prison and the Army's military detention facility. Fort Leavenworth was also a crucial logistical facility for the Army, sending supplies and material to other bases all over the country. And Fort Leavenworth was also the training site for nearly 50,000 new Army recruits each year. More by accident than by a plan, Jean Ford ended up in Leavenworth, Kansas, staying at a small hotel, just blocks from the massive military base. She initially sought a job at the fort, but the Depression had reduced the Army's civilian hiring. They took her application but told her that it would be months before they could consider it. In Leavenworth, Jean Ford made a fateful decision. She would sell the Red Ford and buy a train ticket for California. A nice Army captain from Massachusetts was happy to give her $400 for it. She used $60 for a one-way train ticket to Sacramento, California. She also bought some nice, slightly used, luggage at a second-hand store. She would turn 15 on her train trip to California. The train trip from Kansas to California was one of the true highlights of my life. I did not know it when I purchased the ticket, but my ticket included a Pullman sleeping berth. So soft and cushy. I liked pulling the curtain shut and being in a private world with just baby John and me. I loved the rocking and the swaying of the train. Reminded me of a baby's cradle. I even enjoyed it when the conductor came through the car to announce the next station. My ticket also allowed me to have breakfast in the dining car. Not the luxury one with the special silverware and china. Just the regular one for the regular passengers. But, still very nice to have someone cook my eggs and bacon for me. Very nice. And, I had never drunk orange juice. Little sour, but still good. There was another woman on the train, coming from Chicago to see her brother in San Francisco. She helped me with baby John, taking him when he turned fussy. I loved the two wonderful days I spent on that train. Sad to lose the red Model E Ford, but the train trip was worth it. Sacramento was hot. Over the years that I lived there, I learned it gets that way in late August. It is a dry heat, no humidity. So, it is heat that you can tolerate. Almost. Especially if you are indoors. If you are working in the fields, harvesting crops, then it is just miserable hot. Almost as hot at midnight as at noon. I did not know it, but in 1936, Sacramento was crammed full of Okies and Arkies. Folks from Oklahoma and Arkansas whose farms had failed because of the terrible drought and the infamous Dust Bowl. They had migrated west in rundown vehicles loaded with their family's possessions for better opportunities. They were camped all over the city, particularly along the Sacramento and the American rivers. I was just like them. A poor, uneducated girl with a baby coming from the Ozark Mountains. However, unlike them, I arrived by train and was wearing a rouge-colored business suit. Nobody in Sacramento ever called me an Arky. Sure, I talked like them, but more importantly, I did not look like them. I am now convinced that was the reason it was so easy for me to get a job at the almond processing factory. I looked like a woman of substance, not a transient coming from the camps. My job, for 2 full years, at the processing plant was as an almond shucker. Not many people have seen an almond nut as it comes off the tree. It is surrounded by a large, green husk that has to be removed before the tan-colored, hard shell can be cracked and the nut kernel removed. My job was to remove the green husks and feed the tan-colored nuts into the roller press that cracked the shell. When I told my grandchildren that I was an almond shucker, they imagined me hand-shucking field corn, doing each one by hand. No, the nut processing factory in Sacramento was more modern than that. I ran a machine that shucked the almond husks. My job was to grab the husks after the machine had stripped open the husks by a cutting wheel, and then pull the husk away. Then, I tossed the tan-colored shell, with the nut, onto the conveyor belt for the cracking press. It was factory work, and you had to keep up your pace, but, in reality, it was one of the best jobs on the processing line. You did not have to lift the heavy crates or breathe the almond dust from the crusher. The work was indoors, and they ran the very large fans. I was paid $7.50 a week and allowed to rent a small, company-owned house for $5 a month. I did not need a car since I could walk to work, and there was a small neighborhood market where I could buy essentials. Since almonds don't go bad, they kept the processing plant operating all year. It was the Depression and millions of people needed work. I was glad to have a job. A good job. I worked for the almond processing plant for about 2.5 years. I worked there until I married George McDonald. George was an enormous man. He stood nearly 6 feet 5 and weighed about 250 pounds. He had bright red hair, freckles, and a deep bass voice. In any crowd, he would be unmistakable. A unique, one-of-a-kind, bear of a man. He was also the lasting love of my life. I still feel his loss every day. George and his younger brother Irwin owned the almond processing plant that I worked at. Back in the later 1890s, their father had raised the funding to build the plant, and he operated it until the 1920s when he turned things over to his sons. I have heard some say that the McDonald family pioneered California's almond industry. I don't know whether that is true, but by 1936, when I started working at the factory, it covered many, many blocks in Sacramento and was second only to the Southern Pacific Railroad in the number of workers it employed. I had often seen the two McDonald brothers doing various tasks in the plant. They were not stuffy, wear a business suit types. They wore overalls and boots, and actually worked in the plant, unloading the trucks, fixing the machines, even sweeping the floors. I am, by my nature, a very shy woman. I don't talk very much and seldom joke around with others. I certainly would not attempt to attract the attention of my bosses with female flirtation. That is not me. I saw other women who worked at the factory try that kind of thing, but that is not what I would do. George McDonald liked to talk to everyone. He had lots of stories, lots of jokes, always greeted everyone with a laugh. Easygoing, bear of a man. His brother Irwin was just the opposite. Very shy. Very reserved. Often looked down when he walked around the factory. A couple times a week, George McDonald would come to where I was working and tell me how much he appreciated my hard work. Since he said the same thing to almost all his employees, I did not think anything about it. Then one afternoon, just as I was completing my shift, he came by and asked me a question that I was not expecting. Miss Jean, would you enjoy going to the movies with me tomorrow evening? I was startled. I never expected that kind of question. I looked at him, smiled, and said yes. When I got home, I was racked with indecision. Why had I said yes? I did not want a date. I did not need a relationship with a man. Besides, I had nothing to wear. It was the summer. My rouge-colored business suit would not work. Fortunately, one of my house neighbors had something she would lend me. The dress had puffy sleeves and a pretty heart-shaped belt buckle. She also lent me a pair of her nylons. I was an Ozark Mountain girl from Charlie, Arkansas. I had never worn a pair of nylon stockings. The date with George McDonald could not have been more perfect. But understand, I had never been on a date. Mr. Garrison never took me to the movies. We never went out to dinner. I was his property. He did not need to court me or make me feel special. I was already his. His to use as he chose. George McDonald was the perfect gentleman. Never put his hands where he shouldn't. Never made any crass or derogatory remarks. He looked at me and he talked to me. He seemed to appreciate what I was saying, how I felt about things. On that first date, I learned that George was a widower with a son only 3 years younger than me. He had loved his first wife very much, but she died suddenly from the measles when George Jr. was just 8. George and George Jr. now lived with Grandma McDonald in one of the largest houses in Sacramento. The problem, George said, was that his mother was terrified of electricity and had never permitted electric lighting to come into the house. She had a servant girl who lit the old gas lights every evening. George said that he had converted the old carriage house into his man den. He had electricity wired into it, and he had indoor plumbing for a toilet and a shower. It is there that he listened to the radio in the evenings, usually with a short glass of bourbon. George told me that he had always wanted to learn to dance but had no one to dance with. Now, I am a Baptist woman, and so I have never been to a dance. Still, I promised him that I would go to the Arthur Murray Dance Studio with him, and together we would learn the foxtrot. That's what started our relationship. George McDonald, the 6'5" red-headed bear, and me, a 5'2", dark curly hair, blue-eyed Arky, learning the foxtrot together. When we married, George was 47 and I was 20. The worst day of my life was September 22, 1953. George Jr. had just returned to Sacramento from South Korea. He had been drafted into the Marines in 1950 and had spent 6 months in that hellhole of a place. I had read all of his letters home and I almost cried when I learned what he had gone through over there. We were glad that he was back home and that he was done with the Marines. My husband, George, decided to celebrate by taking George Jr. on a special fishing trip down to the Mammoth Lakes area. At the last minute, he decided to take our 9-year-old daughter Belinda along too. The three of them would camp, fish, hike and enjoy the forested outdoors for a week. I had never enjoyed the camping trips that my husband loved to organize. After breaking my ankle the year before, I could no longer join him on his wilderness treks. Besides, the hospital women's charity group had scheduled a special fundraising event the same weekend, and I had promised to help out. If you have ever traveled south on Highway 395, then you know the steep, downhill grade just before Mammoth Mountain. The truck drivers hate it. For a very good reason. Anyway, my husband was driving our large station wagon, all loaded with camping gear. On that downhill grade, he came up on a slow-moving truck. As he came up on it, one of the truck's tires blew, jackknifing the truck. To avoid hitting it, my husband swerved left. But as he did so, another truck moving northbound on the uphill side of the grade also swerved to miss the other truck. That uphill-bound truck hit our station wagon head-on. Altogether, the accident involved 9 vehicles. 5 people died at the scene. 3 others went to the hospital with serious injuries. In that accident, my husband George, my stepson George Jr., and my daughter Belinda died. September 22, 1953, was the worst day of my life. In 1959, I read a newspaper article about the Sacramento Vintage Ford Model A Car Club, which the article said was the oldest such club west of the Mississippi River. That article rekindled my love for the old Fords. I decided to have a 4-car garage built on the vacant lot behind our house. 3 of the garages were for the vintage cars in various stages of restoration, and one was for the white Pontiac station wagon that I drove. At the club, I met Joe Arena, one of the nicest men I have ever known. Joe's regular job was the chief mechanic at Sacramento's largest Pontiac dealership, but his overwhelming passion was restoring Model E Fords. When I met him, Joe was the president of the club and its resident expert extraordinaire about Model E engines. Joe was extremely kind in teaching me what he knew about rebuilding engines and restoring cars. A patient and caring teacher. We married in 1961 up at the casino at Lake Tahoe. I drove up my blue Model A. And Joe drove up his yellow coupe. After our wedding reception, my son John drove us home in a 1929 Graham, with the top down, of course. Now that was a long, long car. I remember seeing an animated cartoon at the movies, where the car, it looked like the Graham, rolled by. It kept going and going and going. A funny gag. A long car without a seeming end. I loved Joe. Not like I had loved George. That was a once-in-a-lifetime, sweep-off-your-feet love. But I loved Joe in a comfortable way. The way that warm, fuzzy slippers make you feel on a cold morning. Comfortable love is pretty good. Pretty darn good. Unfortunately, Joe Arena died in 1966 from a heart attack while working on a Pontiac GTO that the professional baseball player had brought into the dealership. I was not at home when he died. I was down in Alameda visiting with my first great-grandbaby. The Sacramento Model A Ford Club organized a drive in honor of Joe. 42 cars took part. We left Sacramento and drove to Bodega Bay, which was one of Joe's favorite drives. Of the 42 cars that began the drive, only 3 had any mechanical problems. The club always took along its dependable wrecker truck, loaded with any necessary parts. That way no one was left beside the road, unable to proceed further. About a month after Joe's death, the officers of the club approached me about becoming the next club president. I don't think that it was my leadership skills they wanted. They knew I had 3 well-equipped garages, perfect for restoring cars. I was president of the Sacramento Vintage Ford Club until 1980. By then, the club had grown so large that the members decided to split into 3 separate clubs. I stayed until the split was officially complete, and then I retired. Time for new blood. Time for the newer members to take things in the directions they wanted to go. I did continue editing the club's monthly newsletter. That was fun, and I could keep up with what was happening. Just a personal note. You may remember that I had only gone to school through the 5th grade. Back in Charlie, Arkansas, my family could not afford to buy my school books. Yes, in Arkansas, students had to buy their own books. We were just too poor to afford it. Besides, I was a girl, and nobody in Charlie, Arkansas thought that education did a girl much good. So, it was as an adult that I taught myself how to write and proofread copy, to be an effective news writer. I also learned how to use a 35mm camera to create pictures for the newsletters. I was pretty good at it. Even if I do say so myself.
This is John Garrison. My mother was Jean Ford McDonald Arena. In July 2020, she died from the effects of COVID-19. She was 96, just a month short of her birthday. I have spent my career creating commercials for television. After I retired, I wanted to make a video retelling my mother's life. I have always admired her feisty personality, her intelligence, and her ability to create opportunities out of what others would have seen as calamities. Nowhere were those qualities more apparent than during her original freedom drive from Omega, Arkansas to Fort Leavenworth. She was just 14 years old, and she was nursing a baby, me. The Vintage Ford Club has a tradition of honoring its past presidents with a special drive. Members drive their vintage vehicles to a destination in a celebration of life and love of old cars. After my mother's death, I approached the club with an alternative to the special drive honoring my mother. Instead of a drive from Sacramento to some place in Northern California, I suggested the club join me in redoing her original Freedom Drive, going from Omega, Arkansas to Fort Leavenworth. My plan was simple. We would ship a car back to Arkansas and members of the club would drive it. The trip would cover about 290 miles, and we could do it in 3 days. Meanwhile, I would video the trip, and then edit and narrate the segments. The club's officers agreed to support the trip. The car that my mother drove was red. Unfortunately, the club could not find a red car. So, an orange and black one, with the colors of the San Francisco Giants, was substituted instead. When I arrived in Arkansas, I was surprised that the town of Charlie was no more. It was now beneath one of the state's largest recreational lakes. I did find the famous Charlie Tunnel which Jean's father had worked on. When it was built in 1909, it was the longest railroad tunnel in Arkansas. Of course, the rail line has been long abandoned, and now the state of Arkansas wants to convert the old rail line into a hiking trail. I had the car transported to Omega, Arkansas, thinking it was still a major town. Back when Eugenia married Mr. Garrison, it was a growing and economically viable community. It is not today. Omega was doomed by the new interstate highway that bypasses Omega and runs 11 miles to the west. Today, it is reduced to a mere 400 residents. It has only one convenience store, and the store no longer sells gasoline. We had to fuel up at the bait shop. Omega's elementary and its high school have been closed. The town still has one church, but it is currently seeking a new minister. The major industries now seem to be selling bait and repairing boats for the visitors to the recreational lake. I did find the house where I was born, but it lacks both a roof and windows. I had always envisioned that house as large. Maybe even grand, it is not. I paced it off. It is a 30 by 30 square. My mother never told me, but apparently water had to drawn out of a well with a hand pump. I believe I found the street corner where, my stepbrother, Caleb and my father shot at each other. Before I came to Arkansas, I searched the online newspaper archives, but could find no mention of the shooting or what happened to Caleb. Forgotten events in a forgotten town. While I am writing this from the perspective of the 21st century, I cannot accept the notion that my mother enticed Caleb to do what he did. I do believe, however, that perception caused my mother to flee Omega. She was running from that perception when she hastily drove the red Ford out of town. After a day exploring and tuning up the Ford, we began the recreation trip. Our trip from Omega to Fort Leavenworth took the same country roads that Jean did. Much of the country looked just as it did in 1936. However, there is one major difference between now and then. In 1936, the backroads of Arkansas had many small communities lining them. Today, nearly all of them are gone. In 1936, it would be relatively easy to find a place to buy gasoline. Today, all the gas stations are large, self-service stations located just off the freeway. And, today, $2 worth of gas wouldn't buy her very much. Still, in the country, we were able to reproduce much of what she experienced. Not so with Tulsa and Leavenworth. Both have become very developed metropolitan areas, with many extensive suburbs. Now, you enter both cities by major freeways, where today's cars zip by at over 70 miles an hour. I said in my narration for the video that I now believe that my mother would not have enjoyed driving her car in either of those two cities. Too big. Too complex. Too scary. I imagine that if my mother undertook such a trip today, she would have avoided urbanized, metropolitan areas. In Tulsa, I tried to find the building for the insurance company where she briefly worked, but that whole section of the city was obliterated with the freeway's construction. In Leavenworth, the old Union train station has been beautifully restored. I filmed the building and found a docent who could retell some of the station's history. After the team had finished the trip, and I had edited the video, I mused about what to name it. I thought about Eugenia. But the trip was about leaving that identity behind. I also thought about the red Model A. But the car was a vehicle, literally, for the change. However, the change was about more than the car. Finally, someone suggested a woman of substance. That name seemed to fit her just fine. Jean Ford. That's Jean with double letter N and an E at the end. That suits her just fine.
Appaloosa Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.
In dedication to Mrs. K. Fetner.